The young Gandolfini is a gamble paid off. He gives the film lifeblood. That's Danny Lee of Financial Times talking about the many saints of Newark. Oh, baby. The moment of truth has come. I got to watch the world premiere last week, and then I attended the after party. I got stories on both. We have one of the great authorities in The Sopranos, Alan Sepinwall, who is the writer of The Sopranos Sessions. He went through every single episode. He and Matt Zoller cites his incredible book. Previous guest here in Cinephile, if you want to go back to listen to Alan. But he's got his thoughts on the movies. And again, I know what you're thinking, right? Spoiler free. I promise you. Well aware of the fact the movie comes out this Friday, October 1st, in theaters and available on HBO Max. I would never spoil anything for all of you as Uber Sopranos fans. That's the new. The old we have, I tell you, I came across this movie on HBO, The Madness of King George. Had never seen it. Came out in 1994. I knew that Nigel Hawthorne was nominated for Best Actor. I finally saw it. Excellent movie. And it's totally not my vibe. I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. And our wild card, I saw this tweeting a couple weeks ago, people talking about greatest closing lines in movie history. So I've got a few I'll throw at you. And as always, want to keep this interactive. You can tweet me at CinephilePod and add me in S. Ferg. Please do go to Apple Podcasts where you can subscribe, rate, and review. Give us some love here on the podcast. Let us know how we're doing. The good news is, Chris Cody, we get to hang out a couple times last week. Not just Cinephile, but Thursday I made an appearance on the Dan Le Batard Show. Mm-hmm. And then on Friday, me and Mike Schur wrap things up. Watch party, Yankees, Red Sox. Me and Mike, now we're good to go.
I feel like, you know, you didn't bring as many fireworks to this appearance, but I feel like you and Mike Schur had a nice thing going on. You talked some hardball, and it was good. It was like I said, I prefer the fireworks. So, like, I would have preferred, you know, some more Basset Hound stories, but, you know, it was a good appearance from you. But I just want to say, listening to, like, because we're going to hear from Sepinwall, like, you're about to give your review on this movie. I haven't seen it yet. You guys, all the big wigs over here, get the special treatment. I'm going to see it like the common folk. And I just, like, hearing Sepinwall interview and you break it down, like, I'm just so excited.
That's what I want to start with. Like, what level of Sopranos fandom are you? Because I don't know. You've seen the show in its entirety.
I have seen it. I have not rewatched it like you, like, a million times. But I have seen it. And I'm just a casual Sopranos fan. But I'm telling you, like, the fact that they got his kid playing him, like, I'm all in on seeing this movie.
I think you're more than casual. If you've seen the entire show, you're a Sopranos fan. That's where we go. So let's start with this. I'll set the stage for you. Because to Chris's point, people think, oh, because you're Mr. Cinephile, you got tickets. No. I've seen the show. I saw it in its original run. I was living in Canada at the time. It was like my last year of college when the show came out. I did not watch season one. Saw every single magazine in the world saying this is the greatest television show ever. Entertainment Weekly, Rolling Stone, etc. Told my buddy Jay Natz, we were living together. I said, we got to get this show. You don't have HBO in Canada? I don't. They may do at the time. They do may now, excuse me. But at the time, we had The Movie Network, TMN. So you'd pay like $20 a month, and we're like 20 years old making no money. I'm like, what the hell? We'll get TMN just to watch The Sopranos.
Yeah.
So I started with season two, and then afterwards watched season one. Same thing I did with Breaking Bad, by the way. I don't know about you.
Wow.
I watched season two, and then I saw season one, yeah.
That's interesting. I've never even heard of doing a show like that. Like, is it weird? What is it like watching season one after you, like, kind of watch season two? That's so odd.
Well, it definitely filled in the blanks for me. I'm like, oh, okay, so that's why that character, like that. Oh, so that's why Big Pussy was like, oh, okay, great. Livia was like, oh,
yes.
Okay, cool. It definitely helped fill in the blanks. But by the way, it didn't hamper my enjoyment. Like, I still loved season two when I saw it, and I went back and, like, okay, it's even better than I thought.
Cool.
But I rewatched the entire show because my wife had never seen it, so we binged watched it in 2019. And then for really avid fans here of Cinephile, they know that every episode I went through and kind of broke it down as I was rewatching, which was a lot of fun to do. And then, of course, during the pandemic, I watched, I've seen Long Term Parking at least 5 or 6 times. There's certain episodes that I particularly love and I've seen a lot of times. What's interesting is that David Chase, I've now listened to him on 3 interviews. I listened to him with Mark Maron. I listened to him on Josh Horowitz, Happy, Sad, Confused. And I watched him with Sepinwall, who did an HBO interview with him. And, like, every single time, he's just a dour guy, serious guy. But what's interesting is he goes, we did this show. It was hugely popular. We won a bunch of Emmys, you know, obviously record-breaking. And it changed television. Like, literally, I'm sure you and I both love Breaking Bad. I know a lot of people love The Shield, Mad Men. Like, all those shows came from The Sopranos. Like, this was the first show where you could say, listen, it felt cinematic. You could have a real anti-hero, a really negative protagonist, and still make the show work. And it changed television, which is amazing to think about. He said, at the time, we were very popular. And he goes, and then, like, 5-10 years later, people were still watching it. And he goes, then the pandemic happened. And he goes, like, I was walking the streets, and I'd meet 40, 50-year-old guys going, oh, my kids are now watching your show. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, like, millennial 18 yeah. 5-year-olds are watching The Sopranos start to finish. Very rare, Chris, you can think of a show that seems to have the kind of staying power as The Sopranos.
Yeah, I mean, I literally can't think of another one. And you're so right about Tony Soprano. Like, the when you think back of the character that you root for that you shouldn't be rooting for, that started with Tony Soprano. Like, there were so many shows after that that followed that path. And it's just Tony Soprano, James Gandolfini. Like, I don't think that there's ever been a better performance in TV. Like, if you just think best performances in TV history, I don't think you're wrong if you say James Gandolfini.
I'm with you, man. Like, you can't ever picture another actor in that role. And The Sopranos at its height, and Sepinwall Zoller-Zeitz made this point in their book. He said, it's the only show that was the most dramatic show on television. Like, clearly, suspenseful, intense, but it was also the funniest show on television.
Yep.
It was the best comedy.
Polly.
It was the best drop at the same time. Polly Walnuts alone. Uncle Junior's one-liners. Like, are you kidding? These guys were hysterical characters.
So good.
And it was so authentic. If you know anybody who's Italian-American, know anybody from Jersey, which is where I now live, they're like, oh my God, the show is so authentic. The mortadella and the sausage and peppers.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways.
Just Tony eating. I mean, just scenes where Tony would just be by himself in that Italian restaurant. Oh my God, eating the bolognese. I don't even know what he's eating. He's just the way you hear him. And I can just, like, it's just amazing. Ugh.
Him eating at Satch Reales is definitely something impressive. By the way, when we first moved to Jersey a couple years ago, I wanted to see all the landmarks. So Holston's, which is the diner, which the final scene happens, is like 20 minutes from my house. So immediately I went there, and I'm like, it's always a lot smaller than you realize. You walk in, you go, oh, that's the diner. I'm like, yeah, that's where Tony maybe got shot, bought some chocolates afterwards. The amount of people going there right now is ridiculous, because now The Sopranos revival, everyone's going to Holston's. It's like a pilgrimage. I can't think of many things in life. You go, oh, we got to go to the diner where the final scene of The Sopranos was. So back to Chris's original point, inferring that I'm some sort of bigwig. No, no. The reason I went to this movie is I paid for it, okay? I get alerts on my phone because I went to Sopranos Con a couple years ago, which is exactly as it sounds. I paid $250 to go, and you literally lined up for 30 minutes to an hour to meet members of the Sopranos cast. So I met Donna Chinesi, Uncle Junior. The line for Adriana, ridiculous. I mean, every perv is there, like, 2-hour wait. Like, I'm not going to do this. But Polly Walnuts, like, I mean, it was amazing. Like, aside from Gandolfini, who of course had passed away, Edie Falco was not there, Carmella, but like a lot of the minor characters were there. Like, Burt Young was great, got to meet him, and a lot of the people were very, very friendly. And so at that Sopranos Con event, afterwards I sent up some mailing list, and so any sort of mob thing happening, I get sent to. Like, they're going to do another Sopranos Con, unsurprisingly, bring back the same people, and they're going to do other events. So I saw the email about a month ago saying, hey, be the first to watch the Sopranos prequel, The Many Saints of Newark, at the Beacon Theater world premiere, part of Tribeca Film Festival. So the tickets alone, Chris, $90 each. And let's be clear, I don't think you've been to the Beacon in New York City. It's a very famous place with a lot of musicians, I think. The Allman Brothers used to play them all the time. But, like, we're, like, in row Q. So, like, we're four rows up from the top. The first thing my wife was like, God, like, we are high up here. Like, hey, we're here, though. And everybody in that crowd was there because this is it. This is the debut. But 200, like, 180 for tickets, 50 for parking, 100 plus for the babysitter. Like, $350 to be at this experience.
Yeah, but when you're the Sopranos fan you are, though, this is worth it. This is a nice Correct. This is a nice night out.
100%. There's not, I mean,
you got to go to the after party, too, though. So let's
No, but let's make that clear, though. You're right. So the after party, which I will tell stories about, that was purely through Metalark Media and our friends at DraftKings. But we're like, oh, if you're going, we'll get you the after party. So you're right. That did soften the $350. Like, okay, movie plus after party. I think it's all going to be worth it now. But it was an amazing experience. We go there. Robert De Niro, of course, because it's through Tribeca, his film festival. He and Jane Rosenthal introduced David Chase. He goes out there to zero enthusiasm, but the whole crowd's going nuts. He introduces every member of the cast. Alessandro Nivola, who's playing Dickie Moltisanti, introduces Gandolfini's kid, introduces, as he put it, the divine Vera Farmiga, introduces Ray Liotta, who shuffles out. I'm like, oh my God. And then the movie starts, and we're like, oh my God, this is actually the moment of truth here. The movie's going to go, masked up, everyone is, you know, quarantined and ready to go. So, this segment of Cinephile is sponsored by Warner Brothers in partnership for their new movie, The Many Saints of Newark. Now, last week, as I told you guys, I was going to be at the premiere screening, and now it comes out in theaters on Friday, and I get to tell you all about it. Here's the key thing. I'm not going to mention any spoilers. I'm just so excited to talk about this film. So, I'll give you the plot synopsis, which is being given right now, because I don't want to give anything away. Young Anthony Soprano is growing up in one of the most tumultuous eras in Newark's history, becoming a man just as rival gangsters begin to rise up and challenge the all-powerful DeMeo crime family's hold over the increasingly race-torn city. Caught up in the changing times is the uncle he idolizes, Dickie Moltisanti, who struggles to manage both his professional and personal responsibilities, and whose influence over his impressionable nephew will help make the teenager into the all-powerful mob boss we'll later come to know, Tony Soprano. So the movie starts out, at first, I'm not going to give it away, but the narration comes, amazing, because it already puts you in that world. And it was just so fun to be back in that world and to do it, Chris, with people who are such rabid fans. Again, nobody accidentally said to themselves, oh, it's a Wednesday night. Let me go to the Beacon Theater and pay hundreds of dollars to watch The Many Saints of Newark. No, you're there because you're a diehard. Mm-hmm. You've seen the show many times. You're all in. And it was just so refreshing. It's like being back in a lovable armchair that you love. Like, you're just so comfortable again, back in a suit that still fits. You're like, all right, here we go. And I think the best news is this. If you don't know The Sopranos, just as a standalone gangster film, I still think you're really going to enjoy the movie. It has compelling characters. It's got violence. It's got treachery. It's got betrayal. It's got sexy women. It's got all the stuff you'd expect, all the hallmarks of a mob movie. But it also has a real reward for Sopranos fans, which is lots of so-called Easter eggs. You know, back when you used to have DVDs, you get these Easter eggs and look them up. Mm-hmm. There's a half a dozen laughs in this movie, Chris, that was only generated by the people in that audience being so smart and so knowledgeable about The Sopranos. Again, my wife saw it with me. She's kind of chuckling, but like, we're roaring because I'm like, oh yeah, if you really know the show, you're getting why that reaction shot is just so funny. So that was the overwhelming feeling I had watching the movie. It was so great to be back. It was so refreshing. I don't think you have to have known the film, know the show, excuse me, to know the movie, but even if you haven't seen it, you can see how Tony Soprano became this iconic gangster. And if you haven't seen the show, hopefully the movie will prompt you to do that. You watch the movie and go, okay, now I want to go back and see the show. As far as characters that you would know if you know the show, again, Dickie Moltisanti's reference in The Sopranos, that's the father of Christopher, played by Michael Imperioli. You've got Vera Farmiga playing Livia Soprano, who is incredible, obviously, in the original show, Nancy Marchand, before she passed away. Johnny Boy Soprano, who is Tony's dad, that's played by John Bernthal. Leslie Odom Jr., who I love, he was obviously in Hamilton. He plays Harold McBrayer. That's a new character. And then Michael Gandolfini as Tony Soprano. So you get a sense of how these characters were created. I think what's really important is the pacing of the movie. It's only 2 hours long. David Chase made it clear that he did not want to make something that was too long, or he really wanted to make it be a movie. And I think the big thing is right now, you want to see it in theaters, because that's where you're going to generate, I think, the most excitement. As I'm telling you, I was there. It's a communal experience. That's the whole point of going to the movies, is to have this shared experience. And again, as a mob film, I think it's excellent. But as a Sopranos film, it's a real treat. And the more investment you have in The Sopranos, the more you're going to be rewarded by this experience. And I loved it. I was happy to be there. I hope people enjoyed it as much as I do. It was really, I hate to use this expression, but a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I can only hope we'll get more of this. Even the soundtrack, you know, hearing Sinatra, hearing Coltrane, being back in that era, and very timely. Again, I hear Race Riots, and I'm like, oh, is this based in reference to what we as a country have gone through the last 2 years? And David Chase is like, no, I just always want to tell this story. And Tom Fontana, the great writer of Oz and Homicide: Life on the Street, he first told him, he goes, you know what? I'd be kind of curious to see what happened when Johnny Boy was a kid, like him and Dickie running around together. He's like, oh, you know what? And David Chase's family's from Newark, and Newark is where the show was set, in New Jersey. Oh, in 1967, there were race riots. So he said there was all this intrigue around it, the whole idea of Italians and blacks and growing up and being impressionable and family. And again, I think they do a really smart job of tying it all together. It's fascinating. When you look at shows that are so beloved, you feel like, how much of it do we have to do for the fans, and how much of it are we doing for the common folk? The best compliment I can pay The Many Saints of Newark is they tread that line very carefully. And it's something that will be rewarded by appreciation by diehards and by casual fans as well. I'm giving it 4 Maple Leafs. I can't wait for people to see it. Again, I think a spoiler-free review here, Chris. Hopefully people will be fired up to see it, right?
Very solid review. I cannot wait to see it. It's in theaters Friday. You got to get your tickets, people. Because you got, I know it's going to be on HBO Max, but you want to go to the, I feel like this is one of those things, if you're a Sopranos fan, you want to go to the theater and see this.
100%. I can't wait to go see it again in theaters here in North Jersey. You'll be seeing it in Florida. Now that we've discussed The Many Saints of Newark, and again, I hope you're all purchasing your tickets to go see it, Warner Brothers and DraftKings have teamed up to give our listeners a shot at $5,000. Think of that, 5,000 cannolis. Head to DraftKings.com/Many Saints to play in The Many Saints of Newark Challenge today. It's free to play, and all you have to do is answer questions about the upcoming film. The challenge ends on October 3rd. So be sure to play today at DraftKings.com/Many Saints. And honestly, good luck. I hope you guys all crush it. Thanks again to Warner Brothers for partnering with DraftKings for The Many Saints of Newark in theaters and streaming exclusively on HBO Max as of Friday. You get to see how Tony Soprano is made. Now we get to the goofy stuff, the after party. So the
give,
movie.
Give the goods. Give it up.
Oh, yeah. And they have a shuttle bus. First of all, taking us the after, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So it's right on the Beacons at 74th, 75th on Broadway. Go outside. People are lining up. We see one of the minor characters in the movie. My wife's like, oh my God, like, a couple people are kind of talking to him, getting a picture. I'm like, should I get a picture? I'm like, yeah, I don't want to bother the guy. I mean, he's a nice guy, but leave him alone. It's fine. We see one of the other kids who's actually Gandolfini, like, as a really young kid. So Michael Gandolfini plays Tony, but then there's a guy who plays Tony when he's like 8 years old. Like, oh, there's that kid. He's outside. He's got a nice little suit on. I'm like, I don't want to bug this kid. We go on the bus. We head there, and it seems fairly quiet, which is to say that you walk in, you see a couple tables, lots of food set up, hors d'oeuvres and such. There's a lot of paparazzi outside. I don't even see paparazzi. Fans. There's fans lining up and such, trying to get pictures, whatever.
Did you get any Adnan? Adnan?
Sadly, there was no Michael Keaton type moment. Nobody knew what it was. But we go in there, and I said to my wife, I go, listen, these things, nobody shows up. Like, Ray Liotta is not going to show up here, okay? We'll get a couple hors d'oeuvres, we'll have some pizza, we'll have some pasta, and we'll call it a day. And as I say that, she looks over and she goes, oh, my God. And she can't react well in the moment. Like, she just, her emotions overtake her. She's like, and again, she likes The Sopranos. She's not at my level, but she loves celebrities.
Yeah.
Loves celebrities. Just likes being in that environment.
So yeah.
And the guy goes, hey, how you doing? All right. And I'm like, it's Steve Buscemi. I'm like,
yes.
Steve Buscemi. Steve Buscemi is not in the movie, by the way, but he was in The Sopranos season 5, as you know, and he directed Pine Barrens very famously.
Yeah.
So the first words out of my mouth are like, oh, Steve Buscemi. I'm like, hey, can I get a picture? And he's like, eh, actually, I'm not doing that. He's with his wife, significant other. Completely shuts me down. Like, oh, my. I just got shut down by Steve Buscemi. Like, why would I? Like, that was so brutal. Like, he's like, actually, I'm not doing that. I'm like, hey, no problem at all. Love Fargo. Love Pine Barrens. Good to see you. Like, all right, have a good one. And I even recovered better because I said, hey, I just heard John Marin. And I did not realize he was a former firefighter.
All right, bring it home.
About 9/11. Mm-hmm. So I brought it home, and he's like, okay, thanks so much. No problem. So then we're kind of like, oh, well, Steve Buscemi, pretty good, okay.
All right, probably not going to ask anyone else for pictures, though. That kind of probably scorned you.
No, my wife really goes, hey, no one's doing any pictures, no more selfies. I'm like, got it. We look over, we see John Bernthal, who plays Johnny Boy. I'm like, oh, my God, my wife's like, oh, I love John Bernthal. But he's clearly in conversation. We don't want to interrupt him. We're like, oh, let's file it away. We'll get him at some point. Then we look over, she goes, it's David Chase. I go, there's no way it's David Chase. He hates this kind of stuff. She goes, it's David Chase. I look over, I'm like, it is David Chase. Met David Chase once before when we saw Death of a Salesman, which is an incredible play. Philip Seymour Hoffman, unbelievable. I remember walking out going, oh my God, David Chase. And he's like, how you doing? I'm like, what do you think of the play? He's like, great. And I said, what are you working on now? He goes, movie. So clearly not a warm-hearted guy. That was my David Chase experience. I'm like, I don't think I want to repeat that again. But then, as I got a little closer to him just to see who else is around, I see Stevie Van Zandt, and I'm like, oh, my God. Like, Lombardi, my co-host on the GM Shuffle, is about as big a boss fan as you'll meet.
Is he wearing the headband?
Had the headband. I'm like, oh, my God, Stevie Van Zandt. Kind of give a head nod. I'm like, all right, Stevie Van Zandt. Like, this is pretty cool. Then it just started to get odd. Like, then we see all the cast. Corey Stoll is there as Uncle June, who, by the way, is great in the movie. It's tough to top Dominic Chianese as Junior, but Corey Stoll does a really good job. We see Vera Farmiga, low-cut dress. We see Michael Gandolfini. Okay. Then it got weird. My wife goes, oh, my God, one of your favorite actors is over there. I'm like, Al Pacino? She's like, it's not Al Pacino. Like, Robert Pacino? No, it's not Robert Pacino. How many people do I have to go? Paul Giamatti? It's not Paul Giamatti. But it is one of my favorites. Ethan Hawke is there. I'm like, oh, I love Ethan Hawke. He's great. Long hair, suit. He's wrapped up in conversation with Bobby Cannavale. I'm like, oh, my God, I love Bobby Cannavale. And he's next to his wife, Rose Byrne. I go, this is unbelievable.
Wow.
And then we got to the biggest one that was the most shocking. This guy has been tarred and feathered because of Me Too. Several women have accused him of inappropriate sexual improprieties. And he's there at the Sopranos after party, wasn't drinking. I looked over, I'm like, had a Coke, had a couple friends with him. Take a guess who it was. I think, forget about whatever may have happened, which I don't support. He's a great actor. I think he's a terrific actor. I'll tell you right now, he's one of your favorite actors, too. Because he's part of that group that you love.
I mean, it's a dangerous game to guess people who have had, like, you know, issues with, like, the Me Too movement. I mean, when you just said people that I like that have had issues with that, James Franco.
Nailed it. Okay. James Franco is at the party. Oh my God. Wow.
Thank you for giving me the hint of someone that I would like, because I was just about to start a shrapnel for people who were in Me Too.
Sure. Dustin Hoffman? Like, no, it's not Dustin Hoffman. So James Franco's there. And my wife's like, oh my God. I'm like, you love James Franco. She's like, yeah. My wife is from the Bay Area. Franco is from Palo Alto. She's like, I just want to mention hey, Palo Alto. And I'm like, he doesn't look in a chatty mood. Like, he seemed like he was with his friends. He was cool. I'm like, it's one of those where you go, oh, when you go to the bathroom, maybe just conveniently run into him. Like, that guy's not going to take a piss. He is locked in there. Franco is not risking anyone going up to him. Like, hey, I know what you did to those women.
Yeah, yeah. So no.
So no, I didn't want to talk to him. But I did talk to Gandolfini's kid, who was great. And we were kind of just staring at him. So again, kind of like Buscemi, he just knew, like, these people are staring at me. I'll just say hi.
What do you say? Like, you don't mention his dad, right?
Because I did. Yeah. I shook his hand. I go, dude, I thought you were awesome in the movie. He's like, thanks. I go, honestly, terrific job. And I said, you know, I was such a huge fan of your dad. You really honored his legacy.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Remarkable stuff. He's like, thanks. And my wife said the same things. All right, thanks so much, guys.
That's nice.
So Michael, get a few words. Buscemi shut me down.
Look at that.
But it was, my wife loved it. She goes, I wish we could stay here until 2 in the morning. I go, why? She goes, they're going to start to get drunk. They're going to get a little loose. We can joke with them and stuff. I go, no, I don't think. I really want to get.
Your wife is like me. That's what I'd be like too. Come on, we're like, staying the whole time. Let's go.
Right, we're staying till 4. I go, no, the sitter. Forget the sitter. The kids will be fine. We're going to stay till 4
I love
in the morning.
Yes.
Now, I love Leslie Odom Jr. because he was so good as Sam Cooke in One Night in Miami. He is there. Of course, he is in the movie. And then him and Ethan Hawke started vibing out. I'm like, oh my God. Those guys were just boom, for 30 minutes, like magnetic fields together. Ethan Hawke, a big theater guy. Obviously, Leslie Odom was in Hamilton, so I think they were just having a big Broadway theater conversation. Yeah. They were like lighting up. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen Dan at a social occasion. Maybe someone really loves his work. He likes their work. They kind of cling together. Ethan Hawke and Leslie Odom Jr., they were in love with each other.
Dan is so socially awkward. You have to think of someone else for that. I mean, Stugatz maybe, but like Dan
If Stugatz saw Dan Marino, maybe Dan Marino liked. I mean, yes. I know Stu's not a Dolphins fan, but maybe something like that.
Exactly.
But it was definitely my thanks to Ashley Ricks who hooked it up. She was so great. I mean, just to be able to have that experience. Honestly, thanks to DraftKings. My wife, she said to me after, she goes, hey, the big thing is this. Can we do more of these? I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, we got here because of your association with Meadowlark and DraftKings. I'm like, yeah. She goes, so what's the next big one? We got to get more celebrities. I'm like,
me and your wife are very similar.
Unbelievable. I go, well, like, Dune's coming out October. Okay, Dune, go to DraftKings. See if there's a Dune contest. I go, all right, no. If we can hook it up, Tony Aluti can. All right, we'll see. If Dune is holding a premiere in New York City, we're going to be there.
Okay?
We'll
pay for the tickets. I love
it. No problem at all. Anyways, that was my experience. Honestly, an unbelievable experience. The Many Saints of Newark. I hope everyone enjoys the movie. Enough out of me. Let's hear from the authority, Alan Sepinwall, who's as locked in as anybody.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
There's a big dick swinging contest right now with everyone saying, how big a Sopranos fan are you? Well, I've seen the show 5 times. Well, I binge watched it during COVID 3 times back to back. Well, I've actually met a few of the characters. Well, guess what? Alan Sepinwall is the authority, and I'll tell you why. I'm holding up the Sopranos sessions, which I have the uncorrected proof, which he sent me when I interviewed him previously on Cinephile, the not for sale version of the Sopranos sessions. So Alan and Matt Zoller-Seitz went through every single episode. So I'm going to say this. Not only have they watched the show multiple times, they've went through every single episode multiple times because they literally do a blow-by-blow of everything. If you know Alan's work, he likes to go episode by episode, his episodic reviews, in fact, the stuff of legends. So you're not going to get a bigger authority than Alan Sepinwall. He is, of course, the chief editor right now of the Rolling Stone, chief TV critic, I should say, and, of course, the Sopranos sessions, available where books are sold. Alan, a pleasure to have you. You are the authority on the Sopranos.
I'm not an expert on a lot of things, but this one I feel pretty confident about. Yes, thanks for having me.
Of course. Before we get into the movie, I love the 30-minute interview you did with David Chase. So I watched your interview with him. I listened to him on Marc Maron, and I listened to him with my buddy Josh Horowitz, Happy, Sad, Confused. All three interviews, David Chase, of course, coming across, as you'd expect him to be, dour, serious, intense. I was just thrilled. At least he name checks you. Like, he obviously knows you. Alan, how are you? Nice to see you again. And you were following the classic model. You know, at ESPN, we had a Canadian, great Canadian, John Sawatsky, would teach us either interview questions, as you know, open, lean, neutral. Open-ended, lean means make it short, and neutral, unbiased, which is the hardest one. You can't say, David, why didn't you make the film more like this? Okay, well, it was lean and it was open, but it wasn't neutral. You're giving him open, lean, and neutral questions, and David Chase is just completely unimpressed with the entire process. At any point, do you feel like you're talking to the Bill Belichick of media and sports media?
Well, I mean, I feel like if covering The Sopranos as long as I have, going back to when the show was on the air and I was at the Star Ledger, which was Tony's favorite newspaper, it almost feels as if, like, I am a Patriots beat writer. I've interviewed David so many times, more than I've talked to anyone else professionally over my career. And so by now I've learned, like, what kind of questions he will respond to and what kind of questions he won't. And also, like, how long to wait out the pause, because sometimes he's pausing to think and sometimes he's pausing because he just doesn't care and doesn't want to respond to your question. And it's a real, like, delicate balance.
Yeah, it helped that it was on camera, because you're right. I don't think he can pause as long, because even he's aware that it's going to look awkward. But that pregnant pause he'll give sometimes, it's stuff of legend. So credit to you to hang in there. All right, the movie itself. I've already given my review as we DM'd. I was curious for your thoughts. You have not posted your review yet. We're recording this on a Wednesday. This is going to post tomorrow on the 30th, and hopefully by the time everyone listens to it, they'll have seen the film. I'm going to do this as broad as possible. What'd you think of the movie?
I really enjoyed the movie. I had a lot of fun watching it. That said, I will say it feels to me like it's a very good movie that could have been a great one. And one of the things I talked with David about in that interview in LA that's on Rolling Stone is, like, he's always wanted to make a movie. And in his mind, movies should be 2 hours or less. And so he was very adamant. This wasn't like the studio cut it. He insisted on cutting it down to this. But with the Tony and Olivia scenes and Uncle Junior and a lot of those other characters, you can fill in the blanks because you know them really, really well. And they're also played by great actors here. With these other characters, I think they're very well played as well. But it's still like there's stuff very palpably missing from this movie. And I think if he'd been willing to do a 2.5 or a 3 hour cut of it, the studio would have said yes, and I think it would have been better. As it is, I was still just very happy to be back in this world and like feeling the same feelings I often felt watching the show.
That was one of the best questions you asked him about the running time, and he made it clear. He goes, no, I'm going 2 hours or less. It was very important to me. Now, I listened to him, again, with Horowitz's podcast, and he asked him, what do you think of The Irishman? And I'm thinking, Chase, after hearing your interview, is going to say, well, I liked it, but it was a little bit long. But, of course, he's not going to discourse as he publicly.
Never. He, said, no, he would never discourse as
he. No. And he said, he goes, I thought it was a great film. I learned a lot about the labor stuff, the union, et cetera. But with his answer to you, it was very telling that, like, hey, I think movies today are a little too long. I want to make this thing nice and short. But it's the rare film, I agree with you, in which brevity is not a strength. And I watch it at the Beacon. Listen, nobody is getting into that crowd, Alan, unless you're a rabid fan. We're paying $100 a ticket. Everyone's laughing at the exact same spots. As you messaged me, and we're not going to give it away, but the ending, you go, hey, what was the reaction? Like, are you kidding? Everyone started roaring. It was like fucking Superman showed up all of a sudden. I'm like, yeah, they everyone went nuts.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. And I tell people, I say, listen, if you're a fan of The Sopranos, you're going to be happy to be in that world, as you said. You'll get more out of it the more you know it. There's about half a dozen jokes that I'm like, okay, that's only for the Uber fan that really knows the show well. You mentioned the performances in a couple specifically. I walked out of the theater, I'm with you. I thought Leota was nails, as always. And it was interesting when obviously De Niro and Jane Rosenthal introduced David Chase, and then as apathetic as ever, he introduced the entire cast. The guy that I walked out of there, and I was happy to see him at the after party, was Michael Gandolfini. And he was the one that I go, hang on, this could be a little tricky. Like, yeah, I know it's his dad. I mean, it looks like his kid, but can he actually act? But Al, he clearly watched the show. He clearly put in his homework. I mean, those scenes, those are the best parts of the movie for me. Him and Livia together, two characters who were so identifiable in the show, I thought him and Vera Farmiga knocked it out of the park.
Oh, they're incredible. There's one scene in particular where it's the two of them in like the kitchen and they're talking and they're trying to open up to each other. And it never quite works out because it just can't with these two, and we know that. The two of them are so good together. And you're right, Michael, like, he's young. He's done only a couple of jobs before this. And he's taking on, like, one of the great performances ever put on film anywhere. Like, this is an impossible job, and he does it. And it's not just that he looks like his dad. It's he, like, studied, as you said, and figured out what it is that makes Tony tick and how to do it both just sort of from a logistical and physical standpoint, but also, like, he gets something emotionally about it. It felt like I was watching Tony there, which should not be possible, and he didn't. No.
Exactly. And what's interesting, too, is that, you know, when you watch the film, again, I think people who don't know The Sopranos like us are going to say, yeah, like, it's a good gangster film, and I enjoyed it, and I think if you're a Sopranos fan, you'll get more out of it. But, of course, the question becomes, how many more will there be? This is Dicky Moltisanti's story. Okay, we're going to get Big Pussy's story. Are we going to get the story of the Russian from Pine Barrens? Like, I, it's such an odd spot for me. I'm curious your version of it. We love the show. We love the characters. Yeah. But I don't want to see it cheapen and all of a sudden turn into the Marvel Cinematic Universe as The Sopranos. And yet, I could see David Chase grudgingly being pulled back in. In fact, I believe with you, he said, he goes, you don't have to do it. Like, it's not under my purview. HBO owns it.
Yes.
And I would trust Terry Winter if you want to do it. For those who don't know, Terry Winter, of course, one of the great writers, Boardwalk Empire, wrote Wolf of Wall Street. So Chase doesn't have to do it. If it's HBO, Alan, they're going to make 5 Sopranos movies in the next 2 years if they could.
I mean, yeah, I think it depends on how the movie is received. And again, the day and date stuff with HBO Max muddies the water. But like, if people really respond strongly to this movie over the weekend and over the coming weeks, I would not be surprised at all if they went back to these actors and said, look, we want to do something. Because when I interviewed all of them for the series of stories I did for Rolling Stone, like, Michael Gandolfini was said up front, like, I didn't want to do this, and now I would do, like, several more movies. Vera Farmiga just said, look, just make a new TV show and I will play Livia on the TV show. So I think there's enough people there who would be willing to do it. And Chase seems like, even between the time I interviewed him in July and now, seems to have softened a bit even more on the idea of it continuing, you know, or bringing in somebody like Winter to do it. So I would not be shocked if there was some kind of follow-up film kind of bridging the gap, because there's certainly still more to tell about young Tony between, you know, when we see him as a teenager in this movie, as an adult, and we've had some of it alluded to, but if they wanted to do more and we got to see these guys doing it, I would enjoy that.
I can't recommend The Sopranos Sessions enough. It's a brilliant book by Alan and Matt Zoller Seitz. They literally go through every single episode. They've got an extensive interview with David Chase. You know, I've seen the series start to finish twice. I've seen individual episodes many times. HBO, as you know, is now running episodes in anticipation of the prequel. I watched, just for fun, I had a few minutes, I watched Second Opinion again, which is season 3, episode 7, which has one of the great Uncle Junior moments ever, which is him and Tony going back and forth. And also I watched Amour Fou again, which, as you know, is such a showcase for, such a showcase for Gloria. And you know what I love about it? Because you can appreciate this. We can nerd out for a second. Just love Dan Grimaldi as Patsy Parisi, because he never really had a moment or a signature scene except for that one. When she tells him, hey, this is standard operating procedure, and he pulls out the gun, they're going to be scraping your nipples off the interior here, and the last face you're going to see is not Tony's, it'll be mine. And he's got this milquetoast face. Like, he's got the face that you would not want to see before you die.
Yeah.
You know, it won't be cinematic.
Is one of my favorite lines on the show. Because it's funny, because like, that's what Sopranos was always determined to be, was not cinematic. Like, it looked great. It looked like a movie in a way that a lot of TV shows at the time didn't. But in terms of like narratively, it wasn't glamorous. They always sort of steered towards anti-climax. You think like Tony and Furio are going to fight by the helicopter or something. That never happens. All these things that you expect don't happen. And so like, that's kind of like a signature line for the show right there.
Oh, it's so good. I was at SopranosCon a couple years ago, and then I posted I was there, and then you messaged me, hey, come by, say hi. So you were there as well. I didn't see you there.
Yes.
But God, what an experience. I mean, the lineup to see Adriana was just absurdly long, but I did get to meet Dominic Chianese, and I enjoyed, again, geeking out with some of the so-called minor characters. You know, Jason Serbone was a nice guy. Jackie Jr., it was good to meet you know, some of those more supporting characters. I mean, even the guy, I don't even know his actor's name now. It's Armin Garrel, that's his name. Armenian guy who late in the series, says to Meadow, you got a little bit of whipped cream there, I'd be happy to add to it. And then later on, Tony beats the absolute crap out of him. I mean, those kinds of characters, you go, oh, you're the guy who made the pig-headed comment to Meadow in season 6. Like, what an experience Sopranos Con was. I couldn't even imagine. Listen, I know there's Comic-Con, but the fact that you were there in the Meadowlands experiencing that, how bizarre was that? How great was that?
It was very fun. It was super exciting. It was really weird. Like, suddenly Matt and I just sat down, like, in Dr. Melfi's office. That's currently, like, my author photo. The next book I have that comes out, it's going to be a shot of me sitting in Dr. Melfi's chair, because it's, like, one of the better pictures anyone's taken of me. But it was just seeing these guys wandering around, and suddenly you turn, and there is Jackie Jr. You know, at one point I got, like, pulled on stage, and I'm standing next to, you know, Vincent Pastore as Big Pussy. I'm like, wait, what is happening here? It was a delight.
Yeah, Vince Curatola, fantastic as well. You guys got good stories about him, Johnny Sack, just how he got the role and went out for a smoke and all the rest of it. I do want to touch on a couple of things. Just your career has been so great, and I've been so impressed by just the longevity, because in a world in which I feel like criticism isn't valued as much as it once was, because now everyone can tweet their review and say, okay, that's it, you're still a guy who is prolific, who cares about the medium, who cares about criticism as an art form. And I go back to The Night Of. It was one of your great reviews ever, because again, you were going episode by episode, which I loved. Yeah. And I just want to give you a very specific compliment. When John Turturro, in the one episode, he convinces or tries to convince Riz Ahmed, he goes, take the deal. I wish I could have 20 more years of my life. Like, just take the deal. Serve some time and you'll get out, because you're not going to win. You made such a perceptive point. You go, you'd never see that in a show. Every show, the lawyer says, fight the case. I'll fight to the death for you. Yeah. I know you're innocent. You'll get this. I thought that was such a brilliant point that you made. What a great show it was from Steve Zalian, that in this case, the lawyer, who's got these horrific feet and all the rest of it, he's telling, no, kid, take the deal. I'd kill to have half of my life, because we might not win this thing.
Thank you. That's very nice of you to say, and I really like that show. And the funny thing is, I'm not sure if you remember this, the Turturro role was originally supposed to be played by Jim Gandolfini. And so he shepherded that thing to the forefront. But in terms of criticism, I wouldn't, there's so much TV now, and it can be so oppressive in some ways that I wouldn't still be doing the job if I didn't enjoy it and didn't, like, couldn't put all of myself into it. And so I'd like to think that the passion that I still feel for it and that I'm putting into my work is palpable, and that's why people are still reading me after all this time.
No question. And like I said, the fact, how did you come upon that idea, by the way? Show comes out, I'll bang a review on the episode immediately. Did you come up with that idea? Your editor, who first said
it? No, it originally came out, I was in college, and I was on like the sort of the primitive days of the internet, like these Usenet news groups. And there was a guy named Tim Lynch, who's like now a high school science professor elsewhere in New Jersey, who would recap episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. And I read these, I'm like, wow, like, you can just write about every episode of a show? That's really cool. And a couple years later, I started doing it with this cop show, NYPD Blue, and that helped me get the job at the Star Ledger, and I sort of moved away from it for a while, and it was The Sopranos, actually, that brought me back to it, because when I was covering the show, they would do an episode like, you know, Ralphie gets his head cut off, and I would walk into the newsroom the next day and say, guys, I have to write about this. People are going to want to read about this. And, you know, I began doing it more and more, and by the last couple seasons, I wrote about every episode, and that just, you know, mushroomed, and that became the thing I was known for.
I loved it, especially particularly with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Can we solve one of the great mysteries of life? How is Ray Seahorn never won an Emmy, much less get a nomination for some of the best work on television?
She's so good, but part of what makes her so good is that she's subtle. You know, and it's the reason, like, Nancy Marshall never won the Emmy for playing Livia on The Sopranos, which is you kind of need to see every episode bit by bit to appreciate all of the amazing things that she was doing and that Ray Seahorn is doing on Better Call Saul. And the way the Emmys work is people are watching one episode. So it's not so much best acting, it's most acting. It's, you know, who is, like, playing a funny drunk? Who is, like, melting down? Who is crying? Who is doing something really, really big in this episode? I will give them that award.
Yeah, it's just frustrating every single time it happens. We'll close with a sports question. As a New York sports fan, what do you want to talk about? Knicks, Yankees, what do you got?
I mean, I thought I was all done with the Yankees and that I was going to be all in on the Knicks for the winter, but somehow the Yankees are surprising me. The two big beefy baseball boys, you know, Judge and Stanton, they're going ham, and it's fun.
The two big beefy baseball boys. I love it. Alan Sepinwall. Make sure you read his book, The Sopranos Sessions. Him and Matt Zoller cites, literally, if you're a Sopranos fan and you haven't read it yet, shame on you, because it's incredible. They literally go through every single episode, and it's so smart and so exacting. And of course, you can read his stuff in Rolling Stone. Many thanks, man. I can't wait now, because literally, we get to watch it for everybody else. So now I'm curious, the cacophony of noise that's about to come.
We'll see. I mean, I wrote an essay that my editor is sort of tearing her hair out about right now, because it's almost 7,000 words. Like, just sort of, I went Soprano session style through the movie, and it should be live on RollingStone.com at some point on Friday. I hope people like it, because I would like for there to be more of these things, because I did really, despite some of its flaws, I did really enjoy this, and it felt good to be back in this world.
Yeah, amen to that. And listen, if I have to sit through all these MCU movies, then damn it, give me a Sopranos franchise I can enjoy as well. Great stuff, Alan. Thanks, man.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right, thanks again to Alan Sepinwall. Support his work on Rolling Stone. Now we get to the old, and I gotta tell you, sometimes, Chris, you take a flyer in a movie, you go, what the hell? The Madness of King George, 1994. Great title, by the way. When King George III goes mad, his lieutenants try to adjust the rules to run the country without his participation. It's directed by Nicholas Heitner, and it's written by Alan Bennett, based on the play, The Madness of King George III. I don't know about you and your wife, as far as similarities you may have in shows or TVs, but generally my wife laments the fact that I watch all these foreign films and these old movies, because I don't care, I'm not interested in this stuff. She loves British royalty, right? So she loves The Crown, and I have no interest in The Crown. I'm like, God, no more of The Crown. No more accents, please. Wow. And I have no interest in The Crown. I'm like, God, no more of The Crown.
We have the exact same dynamic in my marriage. My wife loves the royal family, everything, all the shows about it, all the real life stuff about it, and I could not care less.
Yes. Again, Chris Cody for the win. I was like, I just have zero attraction to
That's
it,
why
right?
when I saw you were doing this film, I was like, you know, I watched two last week. Sorry, Adnan, I'm going to sit this one out.
I don't blame you. I literally took a flyer because, like, you know what? 1994 is one of the greatest years ever for movies. And if you just look at the best actor nominees, Travolta for Pulp Fiction, Morgan Freeman for Shawshank Redemption, Hanks wins for Forrest Gump, which is a joke. He's obviously a great actor, and it's a decent performance. The movie's awful.
Wow.
The Lion King, amazing, 94. Quiz Show's a great film. Like, 94 is an awesome year for movies. And I'm like, I do know Nigel Hawthorne was nominated for Best Actor. Let me just check this out. And honestly, I felt like it's more like a favorite of my wife. Because she goes, why did you record this? This isn't something you'd watch. I go, no, it's not. I have no interest in this stuff. But I'll give it 10 minutes. I think you give any movie 10 minutes, and after that, you can punt. And the first 10 minutes is hysterical. Nigel Hawthorne is unbelievable. I looked up some of the reviews afterwards, and the reviews were great. They said, the only thing crazy is how the hell did Nigel Hawthorne not win Best Actor? How the hell did Tom Hanks for Forrest Gump beat him? Like, he is so good in this movie. David Stratton at the movies. Visually sumptuous, energetic, and classy. The madness of King George is British film theater at its most seductive. And the guy's a loon. Like, literally, you're like, what is going on with King George? At one point, he's getting a piggyback for a couple of guys. There's one scene where, because they start to test him. So he starts peeing, which, by the way, goes back to the expression, I don't have a pot to piss in. He's literally pissing in pots, and they got to check it. And the one guy goes, oh, his pee's looking more like lemonade again. And the other guy goes, no, it still looks a little bit inky to me. And they go have to literally dunk the piss in a pond. I'm like, this is just disgusting. What is this movie about? But it's just ridiculous. It's so zany. I mean, at one point, my wife and I were howling. We rewound it and watched it 5 times. He's a little bit constipated. He suffers from constipation. And Helen Mirren, who was also nominated for Best Supporting Actress, goes up to him and kind of like pats him on the stomach and kind of taps his butt and says, tight as a drum, like my man. And he says, saving your presence, I will try a fart. That's one of the funniest lines I've ever heard. Like, the way he said, like, again, you have to watch the movie. You have to picture an old British guy who was the king going, saving your presence, I will try a fart. And then you literally see him sort of squeeze, like, what the hell is going on? This is not the crown. This is not the queen. This is not the Iron Lady. This is the kind of British royalty I can get behind, okay? This is just some guy who's got constipation, and he's literally losing his marbles. He's all over the place. One point, he's just grabbing this woman, starts kissing her, like, no, that's not your wife. He's like, oh, I'm sorry. Ah, starts running around, tearing his clothes off. I mean, just a madcap, zany movie. The Madness of King George, unlike what I was expecting. And before you think it's just some sort of stupid comedy, there's actual dramatic heft to it. Eventually, you're like, oh, he's suffering from what? Is it dementia? Ian Holm, who's a great actor, ends up, they put the king in like a straitjacket. Like, it's horrible. Think about this. This is like 1690s. They didn't care about mental illness back then. So it really was fascinating to think about how would people react. Yeah. And the guy in charge looks like he's losing his mind. And again, Rupert Graves is in the cast as well. It's really well shot. Eventually, the true story that I looked up, because I'm like, how much of this is actually true? Did the King George go nuts, and what ended up happening afterwards? But apparently, the condition that they said he was suffering from was something to do with his urine. And I'm like, wow, okay, so it actually was true to life in the fact that he had this medical condition. Modern doctors believe King George suffered from the blood disorder porphyria, which causes cramps, abdominal pain, and seizures similar to epileptic fits. George's extremely violent attacks led to him being labeled by doctors as insane. So this was the blood, apparently it was inherited. Insomnia, confusion, paranoia, crazy. I learned about history and I was entertained. The Madness of King George.
The only reason I knew King George went mad is because of Hamilton. Like, I know we're supposed to, like, know stuff from, like, school and stuff. Like, I learned that, yeah, King George went mad in Hamilton. That it does, like, I am a little intrigued by this movie. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, listen, especially now that your wife is into this stuff.
Yeah.
It's on HBO, which is, I know where you watched Blood and Wine. Yeah. So check it out this weekend on HBO. And I'm telling you, your wife will definitely like it, and you might be surprised.
If it's funny, if it's sneaky funny, I do like zany and funny, so.
Yeah, sneaky funny. I'll give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. I thought it was very well done, and I can see why Nigel Hawthorne specifically was nominated for Best Actor. All right. As we close up shop, always going to have a wild card. So some of the great closing lines ever.
Let's
in
make
movie
the history. Close of this podcast the best closing lines in movie history. Look at
exactly.
us.
Exactly. We'll be nominated for the best close ever of a podcast. So there's a few in there. Obviously, Casablanca is a big one. Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful mm-hmm. friendship. Humphrey Bogart says to Claude Rains. Back to the Future, which one of me and Chris's yep. favorite movies, where we're going, we don't need roads. Those to me are huge. Chinatown, forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown, very famous one as well. But there's lots on this list. If you just start looking at the great closing lines of movies, those three come to mind, Chris. But I'm sure if you just do a quick Google search, there's a lot that come up, right?
Toy Story 3. That's one. That's the. I know it's a cartoon, but when I saw this one on the list, oh my God! When Andy's driving off to college, so long, partner. I mean, it makes me start getting teared up just thinking about it.
Oh, Dan Stancic, it's one of his favorite movies. He gets emotional in the movie. It's great. It's
very well done. Caddyshack. I'm trying to go for the funny ones. Hey, sure. Hey, everybody, we're all gonna get laid. Rodney Dangerfield. yeah, those are the two that I thought of.
Usual Suspects is a great one because he was the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing him really didn't exist. And he goes, and then poof, he's gone.
I saw Raging Bull was on some list. I'm the boss, oh, yeah. I'm the boss. How does he say it? Yeah, he says that one a bunch.
I'm a boss. Yeah. I'm a boss.
Is Goodfellas, should that be on there? No.
I mean, it's a great ending where he goes, I get to live my life because nobody... I live my life like a schnook. Like, it's yeah. okay. It's more just the kind of the directing, the style of it, the shot of Joe Pesci shooting at the screen.
Home Alone ending with Buzz yelling, Kevin, what'd you do to my room? See, yeah, I'm getting a little random.
I like that you're getting random, though, because compared to Goodfellas, I'm an average nobody. I get to live the rest of my life like a schnook, and you go to Home Alone. How about Seven? Ernest Hemingway once wrote, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part. That's Morgan Freeman's voice.
Yeah. King Kong.
King Kong is amazing.
It was the beauty that killed the beast.
Yeah. Actually, a really good one. That's in the original. Yep. How about Iron Man? The truth is, I am Iron Man.
Yeah. There was a lot of those movies. Like, there's a Spider-Man one where at the end, he's like, I'm Spider-Man. I feel like it's a little played out to, like, end a movie with saying the title in the movie. Like, come on.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say The Maltese Falcon, the stuff that dreams are made of, very, very good. Mm-hmm. Dark Knight, to your point, is obviously rehashing the name of the movie.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard. All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. It's a great one. How about Fight Club? I forgot about this one. Fight Club, the last line is, you met me at a very strange time in my life.
Yeah. Training Day, what a day. What a motherfucking day.
It was Training Day. That's pretty good. I forgot that was the last line. E.T., okay. Some Like It Hot, Nobody's Perfect. That's a pretty good one. Obviously, Jack Lemmon's trying to tell him I'm a man.
Shout out to Greg Cody, The Wizard of Oz. Auntie M, There's No Place Like Home. I mean, that's pretty classic.
I think so. I think we hit the big ones. We got Wizard of Oz. We got Caddyshack. We ran the gamut, okay? Something old, something new, and a wild card.
Look at us.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode of Cinephile. Please go to Apple Podcasts where you can subscribe, rate, and review. Check out previous guests as well. Whoever you're a fan of, please do check out the previous guests. We have some good Ken Burns, obviously Kevin Costner, Ryan Russillo. Next, we're going to have my buddy Will Arnett. He's great, talking Lego Movie. And we'll have reviews of Impeachment, which is the new show on FX. I've seen 4 episodes so far. We'll talk about that. New film called Mass. And, of course, 2 weeks from now, we'll talk about the new James Bond film, Shaken, Not Stirred. Until then, I'll see you at the movies.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.